Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Julie Gottlieb about her book, Guilty Women, Foreign Policy and Appeasement in Interwar Britain. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm a historian at the University of Sheffield. My background is I'm originally from Canada, and I did my first degree at McGill. Then I came to Britain to do my postgraduate research. And after that, I taught at Manchester and then Bristol before arriving at Sheffield in 2003. And the work that I've done has been, there's been a certain strand and a leitmotif through most of my research. And that's looking at the interaction between gender and politics in modern Britain, and looking at some aspects of that that are the necessarily the most covered and fully explored and excavated stories.
And that's one of the things that stands out in your book, which is you're in effect doing an excavation of a history that has always been there, but has been so often overlooked by commentators, has oftentimes been kind of subsumed into this broader story of appeasement. And I was wondering, what was it that led you to focus upon this particular topic about the role of women in the appeasement debates of the 1930s?
Well, thank you. So, I mean, I think it would be helpful to kind of give you a kind of history of my own history and the history of my journey and how I got to Guilty Women. So I started my first major research project, and my first book was about women in the British Union of Fascists. So that book was called Feminine Fascism and came out, well, quite a few years ago already. And there again, I was looking at an organization, the British Union of Fascists, which had always been regarded as a very masculine, male-dominated movement. And as I started to excavate and do the research, I realized that actually the movement relied a great deal on female support. 25% of the membership of the movement was female. There were a number of female leaders, including the first fascist organization in Britain was founded by a woman, Rotha Lynn Tor-Norman. So again, I started to, I tried to work against the grain in political history to reinsert or to resituate women in a very male-rendered narrative of political development. So I came across this book called Guilty Women near the end of my research, actually after I'd written that first book, but I was still interested in the relationship between women in right-wing politics, women in extremism, rather than women within kind of the democratic fold. So I came across this text from 1941 called Guilty Women, written by a journalist, a sensationalist journalist called Richard Baxter, which made all these allegations about women's role in the promulgation and in the dissemination of the policy of appeasement. He assumed and he gave a very, very kind of, sensational story about how women had worked behind the scenes in Anglo-German relations, at the top levels of government, how they had been involved in political and sexual intrigue to put their point across and to try to keep Britain out of the war. And to also he had kind of fantasies of various spy rings that the Nazis had set up in Britain and so forth. So clearly this was a fully factual account, but nonetheless, it was probably asking some important questions, or making, there's no smoke without fire, I suppose, is what I wanted to discover. So I wanted to blow the embers a little bit and to see what I could find in the ashes.
As you describe, women have this very significant role in public policy formulation in the 1930s. And yet you begin your book by explaining how it was that women were written out of this history of appeasement that goes all the way back to the precursor to Baxter's book, which was this very famous book called Guilty Men, written by these three journalists who published under the pseudonym Cato, and how they began establishing the narrative of appeasement that has shaped so much of the debate today, and how in effect the existence of Baxter's book seems to demonstrate how even then there was this sense of you're missing this part of the story. How was it that women were left out even after Baxter's book came out?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So, of course, Cato's famous Guilty Men, which is the cornerstone of appeasement historiography, which sets out this account of who is responsible for Britain going to war, underprepared or unprepared. That was very much, again, a story about men. It had a very gendered aspect in that there was, all these kind of villains or kind of hapless figures who had led Britain down this path. Are often represented in kind of very feminized language and they are kind of anti-heroes. So obviously you can see how they will be feminized as part of that process. But again, there are no actual women in Guilty Men. There is no discussion of women in really any regard here. So it assumes that Britain was a country led by, ruled by, and dominated by men. And that's not the case, because there's another important story here. And that, of course, is the is what I'm trying to show in the book, is that, of course, Britain changes very much after 1918 because of suffrage, because of universal suffrage and, of course, women's suffrage. And women become an integral part of the democratic and the electoral process. And they of course, become MPs for the first time as well, not in great numbers. Between the wars, only 36 women managed to be elected to Parliament in Britain. But nonetheless, they now have a real presence. And for political parties and politicians, they're a target audience for their vote. So women are clearly a big, big part of this story. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect is the actual feminist movement and how the feminist movement reforms and reconstitutes itself after the vote is won. So in one sense, the vote has been won. The suffrage movement has kind of lost its cause. So what does it do? It doesn't just completely disappear and fritter away. What happens is that women redirect their energies into allied or closely related campaigns. And one particular campaign that really kind of captures the imagination of many women who had been suffragists, some of them suffragettes, but mainly suffragists actually, was the peace campaign and the move into international politics and the feminization of international politics, especially after the First World War. And again, the First World War was seen as a man-made war, a man-made disaster, and what was necessary, therefore, was a woman-made peace. So women are immediately embedding themselves in discussion about, as you say, public policy, about foreign policy, about diplomacy. And women need to be part of this new democratized diplomacy, trying to avoid the mistakes of the pre 1914 situation, secretive diplomacy and foreign relations, trying to open things up, trying to make things more transparent, trying to make the whole way that foreign policy is conducted much more democratic and inclusive.
I was thinking also about another aspect of it, which is this change in the political discourse has been created by the war in another respect, which is you have on the one hand this reduction in the number of men, and then you have these women as these survivors in the sense that they have lost all these men in their lives. And in a sense, they have to step up both because to help fill some of the space that's been created, and also because they are very much the ones who've suffered this great loss, and this gives them a position and an issue about which they've been affected very deeply.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and that certainly plays in to the story here. And there's a lot of cases where women see themselves as being substitutes for the men who have been lost in the war. A number of women candidates in the first post-war election, where women not only could vote but now could also stand for parliament. A number of women candidates talked about themselves as substitutes for their dead brother or husband. So that was interesting too, and it's exactly what you're saying. So I think that is important, and women's kind of moral authority gains a lot more importance because of their experience of war and their experience of loss. And again, it's this idea that, man-made politics has led to this destruction and the horror of war and modern warfare. So what we need is a women's peace.
And yet, as you explain in considerable detail, that does not necessarily mean that they are all on the same side of these issues in the 1930s. In fact, they're divided in terms of how they think Britain should respond to the rise of Adolf Hitler. And you explain both sides of it, and you cite a number of prominent women who were participating in these debates on both sides and explain where they were coming from and why they adopted the positions that they did.
Exactly. And that's why it's really important, even when we talk about gender, to avoid essentializing. And I do try to go out of my way to avoid that. I record how journalists, politicians, women themselves essentialized their sex roles and made assumptions about women's attitudes and their attitudes to war and peace. But the story is much, much more nuanced, much more textured than that, as you rightly say. And there's just as many splits and fissures within the female community, if you like, as there are among men. But what is unique and what is different and what I've tried to show is that what happens immediately after the First World War and what plays very strongly still to this day and certainly plays very powerfully in the appeasement debate is the assumption that women are homogenous, that there is a women's vote, that there is a women's peace block. Now, that's essential here. The idea that women will always invariably vote for peace. So that is an incredibly powerful construct in how the appeasement debate is conducted at domestic level. So I think that's important. But yes, as you say, and as I've gone to pains to show in the book, there are as many different positions among women as there are among men. Now, don't forget, women have a very unique and gendered relationship to fascism and to anti-fascism. And there is a chapter in the book which focuses on women's war on fascism. Of course, women felt themselves especially victimized by the fascist regime in Italy, and more so by the Nazi regime in Germany. They were being targeted. They were being persecuted. They saw the clock being turned back on their emancipation and their rights. And this worried, very understandably, women across Europe and across the West. And British women were at the forefront in trying to kind of develop a feminist anti-fascism, trying to develop the political tools, the cultural tools, and in cultural modes, in novels, in all kinds of texts, in artwork, of fighting, what Virginia Woolf would call kind of this fascist patriarchy.
Now, were those women predominantly on the political left, or were some of them also among the ranks of the conservatives in British politics during this time?
And that's why the story is so fascinating, because there are so many different variables here and so many different combinations. So, yes, generally, the anti-appeasement position was more the position taken by people on the left or within the Liberal Party. Although in both cases, there were a lot of kind of complicated combinations there. There was, the very strong strain of anti-war sentiment and anti-war activism and pacifism were, extremely important on the left too. But there are a number of figures on the right, as you say. This gives us an opportunity to talk about a figure like the Duchess of Atholl, who was a conservative from the right of the party. She had been very much an ally with Winston Churchill when he was fighting against, moves towards Indian independence and the India Act. She was, a staunch anti-communist. But when it comes to fascism and the specter of Nazism, she becomes the most redoubtable anti-Chamberlainite and anti-appeaser. And she actually stakes and loses in the end her political career on that whole question, on the question of Munich and appeasement. There are a number of by-elections after the Munich conference of September 38. So in October, November, and December 1938, there's a slew of by-elections, which are each seen as a mini referendum or as a general election in miniature on the question of foreign policy. And all of the by-elections other than Atholl's are come about for, you know, through natural causes, the death of an MP or a resignation, something like that. However, she steps down from her seat to fight a by-election on this question. And she, you know, she comes out as a very high profile national figure and as an anti-Chamberlainite and sort of says, OK, well, you know, the Chamberlain is wrong here. And I'm going to stake my career on it. And sadly, she loses that by-election in December 1938 and kind of goes down as this. And that is going to be the end of her parliamentary career, although she carries on with various campaigns well into the post-war period, too. So there's a really good example how there are many conservative women, many women, a couple of women amongst the what I call the women Churchillians, who don't follow the kind of stereotypical path of Chamberlain adulation.
And you also have this coterie of women, as you were explaining, who are anti-fascist people, women like Monica Whatley, who were very much at the forefront of this engagement with fascism, based in part upon their personal experiences, based in part upon their, you know, the fact that so many of these anti-war groups had an international complexion, so they experienced secondhand the rise of fascism and its consequences. And for them, it was not so much about the threat of Germany and war to Britain, but the threat that fascism was posing to civilization in Europe as they saw it.
Yes, and you know that's so true. And you know, in the 20s and certainly in the 30s, you know, the general feeling was that democracy couldn't withhold the threat being posed by the dictatorships, and women especially felt themselves, as I say, personally threatened. And many had experiences. I mean, I talk a lot about various encounters. So, you know, we have women are, you know, increasingly able to travel, and that travel is often very political and explicitly political. And they're, you know, they're involved in informal diplomacy and kind of soft power. And they're also involved more and more with the League of Nations. So there is this, on the formal level, women are internationalizing and are, you know, experiencing countries and cultures well beyond their own borders. Now, this then kind of transmutes into what I call the fascist encounter, because it's on many of these trips, whether they be for, you know, leisure or for politics, that British women who are connected, are well connected, some have political influence, but some don't. But then nonetheless, they have this kind of visceral encounter, first encounter often with fascism, and that can kickstart a career or a campaign or a commitment to anti-fascism.
Yet the heart of your book is, when I read it, was about this group of women who were very much supporters of appeasement, who, for a variety of reasons, be it their own conclusions from their separate encounters with fascism, or from their prior positions, or simply from as the issue rose up and they reacted to it in the way so many people did, came out as supporters of appeasement. And you feature a lot of them in the book, and this allows you to describe in some detail the very individual paths that they take and the unique roles that each one of them plays in this debate. Everyone from Neville Chamberlain's wife, Anne, to his sisters, to Nancy Astor, Diana Cooper, Lady Londonderry, and so forth.
Yes. So there are a number of women who you've mentioned who are all, you know, within the circle of power, who are within easy reach of power, but don't necessarily have formal power themselves. Nancy Astor, of course, is the exception there because she was the first woman to take her seat in Parliament. She is she is an MP throughout this period, and she is a, you know, very high profile figure, not always for the right reasons. She's quite scandalous and she has a kind of biting sense of humor, and she often kind of distinguishes herself in Parliament for being undistinguished. But
let's not forget, she's also an American, so there's that strike against her, too.
Sure. Hers was not particularly irrelevant. She is an American. That does count against her very much. And that's that builds up her reputation and kind of public distrust or mistrust of her, which then plays into the whole kind of Clivedon set conspiracy or the Clivedon set myth. It is largely a myth in that there was no such kind of deliberate set or deliberate kind of cabal that was seeking to, you know, to make terms between Britain and Germany. But in a looser sense, there was definitely a group of people who were working towards those ends and were very happy and had no qualms about, you know, socializing with and sleeping with and entertaining the von Ribbentrops and whoever else came to town and was ready to do business. So that is true. And Astor was quite prominent there. But then again, more complex than you would think. The Clivedon set, the Clivedon set myth is very, very, you know, flat and one-sided because she was also a self-identified feminist. Astor. She came with a lot of prejudices, but where she really saw her unique contribution to be was as the first woman MP. And she did feel, even though she was a Tory, she felt that she was there in Parliament to represent women and certainly not just conservative women. So this is important. And in that capacity, she's also very much inclined towards pacifism and towards peace movements. So her pro-appeasement stance has a lot to do with that and not just kind of a blatant and blind pro-Nazism. But she changes very quickly, too. So by 1938, she's going out of her way to disassociate herself, to kind of wash the stain of the Clivedon set charge off her hands. And, you know, she talks to any newspaper that will listen to her about how this Clivedon set story is complete bunk and a real affront to her reputation. So she goes out of her way to do that. And ultimately, okay, the war's already started. She will get behind Churchill, who was, of course, for many years standing her great rival and you know, biting interlocutor in Parliament and outside.
And as you point out, though, she tended to be the exception. And more often than not, the women who had influence were people who were more indirectly connected to politics. I was especially fascinated by your examination of Anne Chamberlain because she's a figure who doesn't receive as much attention even within the narrative of her husband's political career. And yet, as you describe, she is a very noteworthy figure in these political discussions of the 1930s, albeit one that's much more difficult for us to capture today.
I mean, I think, you know, and we've become very accustomed to looking much more deeply at, you know, politicians' personal lives and how their personal and public lives interact and mirror each other. That wasn't as common in the way that we do it today then. However, there, you know, she did get quite a lot of attention in press. She was watched very carefully. She was filmed. She was photographed. And a lot of that watching took place during the Munich crisis itself. And she was definitely, you know, the press was looking to her, and women of the country, or at least that's how the press represented it, were looking to her how to behave, how to react, how to respond, how to emote, how to feel about this whole appeasement question, about this whole kind of, you know, the whole Sudeten crisis. And so, you know, during the crisis, she is, you know, it's reported that she visits, you know, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, that she goes to Westminster Abbey to pray on a regular basis, that she takes walks, in St. James's Park. Men, but mainly women, run to her, cheering her, seeking some kind of, you know, some kind of support and confirmation of their fears and anxieties, and then eventually their relief from her and from her responses. There's lots of talk about her tears. And, you know, she is allowed as a woman, she has the permission, the social and cultural permission to show some kind of emotion, whereas her husband and the male figures in the piece are will be criticized or undermined if they are to show their emotions and you know, their response is seen as too feminine, too weak, soft. So that's important. The other thing is, though, it's about sources. The Chamberlains have not left traces in the way other, you know, leading political figures have. So Neville Chamberlain never kept a diary. What he did do, however, was write on almost a weekly basis to his two unmarried sisters. At that time, they would have been called spinsters, Ida and Hilda. And these are called the diary letters because they do kind of function as a diary. They give us as much insight as we have into his personal feelings, into his intimate responses, into how he was, you know, his psychological frame of mind at, you know, throughout his political career. But what's most interesting to us and for this book is, you know, how what insight we get into his interior during the Munich crisis in the weeks before and after.
And yet, as you, there's another aspect to these letters, of course, and that is the response from his sisters, because it's clear from them that, you know, he is not just dispensing letters, he's receiving letters from them. And yet, so he's getting this advice. And unfortunately, whereas we've given attention to the letters were edited and published a couple decades ago, we don't really have their response as prominent. And yet, obviously, that's another channel by which you're seeing women having this voice in this appeasement debate.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, that, again, thinking historiographically, that's one of the ways in which women have been written out of the story. So these letters have been edited and published, but all we have is his letters, not the responses, not the correspondence. That's, you know, I think particularly telling that, you know, most historians of this, of, you know, in this field have assumed that women, maybe they're sounding boards, but that's it. That's all that we, that's the only role that they play here. They don't interact. They don't actually influence him. He influences them. He provides, you know, insight into his frame of mind. And that's all we need to know. But of course, Hilda and Ida were formidable political figures in their own right at the local level. As the kind of the champions and the preservers of the family heritage, of course, you know, this is the second generation of imminent Chamberlains. You know, they are very much involved with their brothers, Austin, who's already passed away by now, and Chamberlain with preserving that family legacy and perpetuating it. Of course, you know, Neville Chamberlain has achieved the high office that his father had hoped to achieve, but had never achieved, and that his brother had been marked to achieve, and then, of course, hadn't either. So, you know, that the importance of the family legacy and the way that brother and sisters are interacting in kind of constructing that is really key. Now, the letters do exist, and if you go to the Chamberlain Archive at the University of Birmingham, you can also look at the letters from his sisters. So it's not that they have been completely, disappeared. They haven't disappeared from the face of the earth. It's just about how what historians think is valuable or valid, and that again, it, you know, they've perpetuated this idea that the history of appeasement is the history of men and guilty men.
We've been focusing primarily upon the role that some of these very prominent and politically active women, oftentimes socially as well as politically prominent, have been playing these appeasement debates. And yet, as you describe, that's only part of the story because, and you've already alluded to this to some degree, you also have the broader engagement of women as part of the electorate. And by the time you get to the 1930s, women have had the vote now for nearly two decades. And at this point, the parties have evolved methods of outreach and they're beginning to engage women and respond to them. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that role that women generally played in politics in the 1930s, and in particular, the role that they played within the politics of the Conservative Party.
Yes, well, thank you. That is a, you know, really a key aspect here to understanding how women are made to engage or kind of made to step aside when it comes to foreign policy. Because, yes, in 1918, women get the vote. Women are able to, you know, 6 months later, legislation is passed that allows women to stand for parliament. Most crucially, though, all the political parties reform and modernize in 1918 as an understandable response and, to the new legislation and to this expanded electorate. So the Conservative Party modernizes. It creates a women's, a Conservative Women's Association, which had already existed in different forms when women didn't have the vote. So, women are already politicized and mobilized by the Conservative Party and by the Labour and Liberal Party, for that matter, before they're actually citizens, which is a little bit ironic, but true. But certainly, when they have the vote, much effort is made to integrate them not only within the electorate but within the party system, and to mobilize them for party work on various levels: electoral work, social work, electioneering, and a lot of cohesion, trying to get the party to think as one, and to create this kind of Conservative Party culture. So women are really important in those respects. And many women come into the party at local level and work their way up to regional or national level through that route. So the Conservative Party is very good at responding to what they perceive to be women's needs, but they represent women in very different ways than the feminist movement does, for instance. So you don't have conservatives talking about women as feminists. You don't have conservative women talking about themselves as feminists, which is why Nancy Astor is such an interesting kind of a special case here. But what conservative women do, how they do feel about themselves, what their political identity is based on, is their citizenship. Is their sense of service. So they talk a lot more about women's duties than their rights, women's duties within the home, within the family, and within the nation. So one of the ways in which they, carve out this role for themselves is by, preserving the peace as well. So again, that will play in to the appeasement debate. So what I wanted to do in the book wasn't just look at, the leading figures and the kind of the cloak and dagger stories about kind of soft power and soft diplomacy. I wanted to think about how women, the woman on the street, of course, there's a lot of talk about the man on the street, but what about the woman on the street? What she or many of her, what they thought, how they responded to appeasement, what they thought and how they felt to the coming of war. Which is really what's going on here. I mean, most women, as sources like Mass Observation reveal for us, most women were not particularly politically educated. Not all men were either, for that matter. And most women feel disengaged, uninformed, sometimes uninterested, even apathetic when it comes to foreign policy. There are many who are engaged, and I've looked at those different cohorts. But I think the vast majority of women do feel that they don't have a direct role to play. So they feel, on the one hand, disenfranchised from these fundamental decisions about their lives, about whether their nation will go to war, whether their husbands and sons are going to be exposed and placed in danger, whether they will be placed in danger. Of course, this is not, as the Second World War approaches, no one's expecting a war to be fought in a faraway country of which we know nothing. They're expecting a war that will be fought over their heads, quite literally, and on their heads. Aerial warfare, bombing, gas masks, and so forth. So there's nobody who's not involved in this, who's not implicated in this new type of warfare. So women, have specific fears that are, gendered as feminine in many ways. And the way that we can come to terms with that is by looking at sources that historians of appeasement won't normally have looked at, such as I said, Mass Observation, opinion polls, diaries, confessional sources. And one source that really stuck out for me, and that I felt was really underexplored, was the letters that Chamberlain received from men, but also and more proportionally more from women during the crisis.
And that's where you get into this very interesting analysis in your book, where you're looking at both the representation of public opinion among women and the effort to try to understand what women actually did feel, to the degree you can assume that the opinions of a group, but also how women served a role in the discourse as sort of representational. And this is where you get into the idea of, you know, the Mrs. Miniver, the idea of the mother seeing who might see their sons off to yet another war and so forth, and how that, you know, ends up playing a role itself. Although, unlike in times past, it's now not just something that's, you know, being directed towards men primarily, but now also it's, you know, that women have the vote, they play as, you know, they themselves can be appealed to in this way, maybe in a way that we would regard as patronizing today, but nonetheless it is, you know, itself significant in terms of shaping that debate that was taking place over the course of the late 1930s.
So, yes, that's right. So modern warfare has this leveling effect when it comes to gender and when it comes to everything else, for that matter. It has a leveling effect, in class terms and in ethnic and other terms as well. If the bombs fall, no one is going to be spared. So it's as simple as that on one level. And of course, that is largely what happens. Of course, the gas war that everyone feared, and of course the set pieces of the Munich crisis is the distribution of gas masks, especially on that Sunday in late September, which came to be called Gas Mask Sunday, when everyone went to pick up their gas masks. Everyone is kind of aware that this war is general, is universal, is going to leave them as vulnerable as another. Of course, another important aspect of the women's history of the Munich crisis is the evacuation of children. But I won't probably go into that too much right now. But yes, so there are some experiences which are universal, which transcend gender lines. And then there are some which are more specific to women's, you know, more traditional or biological roles. So mothers will feel slightly differently to things than fathers. But fathers are also, of course, worried for their offspring. And you know, there's lots of testimony in mass observation sources, etc., of men being, you know, very, very fearful of their own death or the death of their loved ones. I mean, that's just just the most human concern that we can imagine. But again, one of the ways that we can kind of, how do we get insight into this? How do we understand how people really felt or what they thought? And again, one source that I tried to, you know, really use for this purposes were the letters that Chamberlain received from around the world. But, you know, of course, the majority of them were from his own countrymen and countrywomen. And he received between 20 and 40,000 letters of gratitude and praise in the weeks of the crisis. And he relied on these letters in ways that we think have been really overlooked by other historians. I mean, it really built his kind of sense of self, his sense of purpose by receiving these letters. Now, there's that most famous passage from the speech that he gives on the BBC just before the dramatic kind of turn of events, where he's invited to Munich. This is on the 27th of September, 1938. And he says, as most people will remember, he says, how horrible, fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. Now, this is, you know, again, iconic kind of Chamberlain myopia and isolationism. But what he says right before that, in that same broadcast, is that he's come around to this view, not necessarily because of his own feelings, not necessarily because of his own kind of reading of geopolitics, but because of the letters and the prayers for my success, as he says, that he has received. And as he says it himself, most of these letters have come from women, mothers or sisters of our countrymen. So two things to notice here. One is that women in large numbers are writing to Chamberlain to try in any way they can to get their feelings across, tell him how deeply grateful they are, how much they don't want war. And the other aspect is that Chamberlain's listening. He makes a commitment to reply to every single one of these letters. And that's something that the newspapers pick up on a lot. In fact, I know that he actually employs a number of extra secretaries at this time to fulfill that promise, and even a special printing press is made for him to turn out these letters of reply. All right, so this is how he's engaging with public opinion, that he has the public, the people, and the women especially on his side. That is really essential for how he sees himself and his conduct in these most tense international relations.
I have to say, I love the label that you give them in the book, the Munich Mums, because it does seem to convey both their role, but also it's just the degree to which Chamberlain has sort of adopted them and used them as perhaps a shield, or perhaps even in a way a sword, to say, you know, this is what it's about, that we're doing this as a means of reaching out to them, and especially considering that what Munich was in 1938 was, and this is, of course, you know, how it comes to be portrayed by Winston Churchill and others as, you know, caving to dictators, which is sort of the image of Munich that we have even to this day. But Chamberlain's saying, I'm doing this for them, and I'm doing this so that, you know, because this is what the people want.
Yeah, and that's very much the binary here. That's the emotional binary between relief and shame. And you know, Chamberlain doesn't feel that shame for many months to come, but immediately lots of people are feeling that shame, that biting, you know, really, really kind of stinging shame. But even those who are anti-appeasement, who are anti-Chamberlain, who feel that, you know, Britain has definitely, you know, made it an absolute fool of itself in caving. Even those people, like the Duff Coopers, the Diana Coopers, figures like nobody can help but all not feel relief. I've been rereading Virginia Woolf's diaries. Now, she wasn't a staunch anti-appeaser. She was much more of following kind of her pacifist path. Although her husband Leonard was much more of a staunch anti-appeaser, but still, both. I've just been looking at his autobiography and rereading her diaries, and they both feel immense relief. Those last days of September and those first days of October. And, you know, they admit to it, but that militates against this shame. You know, people are really stuck in a quandary between a rock and a hard place, morally and emotionally, because, you know, nobody wants war, right? Nobody will ever claim that they want war. Churchill doesn't talk about the need to go to war. That's not what he is, you know, that's not how he is opposing the appeasers. Nobody talks, you know, about war. That's why, going back to the Duchess of Athol for a second, she is portrayed as a warmonger, and that's enough to sink her in her election bid, because no one wants to hear the word war.
And yet, as you explain, this becomes part of the criticism, sort of like the germ of criticism that develops and grows after the war breaks out in September of 1939, that you have this growing criticism of the role of women in appeasement, and more broadly, you know, the a lot of the criticism of appeasement more generally takes on this gendered language of representation of you know, weakness, caving, whereas, you know, the response should have been to stand strong and be more, if you will, manly.
Yes, indeed, and I mean it's unfortunate but inevitable that, you know, that you have this kind of feminization of kind of peace work and the idea of peace and appeasement. I mean, of course, the term appeasement itself is very much in transition too. When, you know, Chamberlain talks constantly about, you know, a European appeasement, it's not a bad word yet. And then as it becomes a bad word, it also becomes feminized, which is, you know, an interesting comment on how we conceptualize and how we kind of, as you know, how we damn a policy.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, I was wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now.
Thank you. And thanks for all the great questions as well. So now, yeah, I'm moving on in a connected fashion from Guilty Women. And I really became fascinated by the emotional response, as you might have gathered with some of my comments today. And what I thought might be a really interesting prism through which to understand the emotional response was through the study of personal crisis and the relationship between personal crisis and national crisis. And I'm going to be looking specifically at suicide and a perceived or apparent suicide epidemic, which accompanies the Munich crisis and the months leading up to the outbreak of war. So I see suicide very much kind of as a chance to provide some kind of political autopsy of the prelude to war, in that those who, you know, couldn't cope with the next war, you know, made this fateful and final decision. And not only interested in how lives were affected in that way, but how, again, those kind of fateful choices were narrated by politicians, by coroners, by psychologists and psychiatrists, and how, you know, there was this real understanding that the war that was about to be fought was of a different, very different kind than wars of the past. And there was a greater recognition of the psychological dimension. And again, the breaking down, actually, I think, of gender norms. There was a lot more compassion towards those who weren't able to, you know, bring themselves to fight. The role of the conscientious objector changes significantly between the First and the Second World War, and also the suicides. So male suicides, men who have, you know, who have killed themselves because they don't want to fight in another war. They're not usually dealt with in the sources I've seen so far. They're not dealt with in a judgmental way. They're dealt with a lot of compassion and empathy and understanding that, you know what, that's, you know, that makes perfect sense. And we can't fight, you know, we can't force people to brutalize, to become brutalized, to become, you know, inhuman. And kind of survive under this, you know, in these terrible times.
Well, that sounds like it's going to be a fascinating book, and I do very much look forward to reading it. Julie, thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us today, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
It's a pleasure, and thanks again for the great questions.